Hello, everybody. This is William Del Pilar, and this is Fire It Up, your source for unfiltered conservative talk. And what do I mean by unfiltered? Well, if you're pro-Ukrainian, you're not going to like us. That's for sure. We have a great show for y'all tonight. We're going to talk Ukraine, maybe from a different angle. Everybody's poo-pooing on Trump, having pulled the intel, having pulled the funding, and they're talking about people dying. And I'm looking at it from the bigger picture. I'm like, yes, people are dying, and that's a tragedy. But don't look at the United States of America. Look at Zelensky, who refuses to come to the peace talks table. And what Trump is trying to do is hasten peace talks so there aren't hundreds of thousands of deaths over the next couple years. Then we're going to talk, or actually, we're going to talk first about Trump's speech. And I got to look at my notes, but I always keep forgetting it's not technically the State of the Union, but what a show. It was the statesman, the president, the entertainer, and the comedian all in one. And guess what, people? Unlike what Democrats want you to believe, America loved it. And then we're going to get into our hot takes, which, as you know, is our lightning round. And I got to say this, that's becoming pretty popular. So before I get going with the actual topics, let me introduce our panel tonight. We have the beautiful Miss Annette Ross, as always. You know, it's like either her or G. And I think she's, you know. And then we have our guest with us, Mr. Armin Kurdian. He's a retired United States Navy captain. As I was telling him off air, I met him before. I don't know if he remembers. And he's just too bourgeois to sound like a United States Navy captain. But he's also involved in local politics here in California. And Armin, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, let me tell you a little bit about it. No.
A 25 years Navy. I was a naval flight officer. I flew the E-2C Hawkeye. Retired as a captain. Went through the War College while I was in there. Spent about 10 or 11 years of my career doing defense acquisition. So that's like the buying, the research and development test and evaluation of buying of all the weapons and the stuff that our military uses. I've been out for about 6 years. I live here in San Diego County with my wife and my son. And I am involved in local politics. I am elected member of the Republican Central Committee here in San Diego County. I ran for city council in 2022 for my city. I lost by just 30 votes. So vote early, everybody. I know we don't like our system in California, but hey, we got to use it the way we use it. And I've been trying to help recruit and train conservative candidates throughout the county to try to stem the tide here in our beautiful Southern California.
Wow, I did not know you were on the Central Committee for the people out there in the nation and in California. Boy, that's a bleep show right now in San Diego County, from what I understand. It's quite the Peyton's place for you older people who will remember that show from the 60s with Ryan O'Neal and I forget who was the famous woman on there. Yeah, I was too young to watch it. It's just, I don't know why I remember it. But anyway, so let's get down to our topic here. You know, so I want to take a different angle on Trump's address to a joint session of Congress. That's a lot of words for a different name for State of the Union. But it wasn't just policy. As I said, it was performance. 36.6 million tuned in for 100 minutes of stagecraft. It was the longest joint address ever. And it was packed with props, surprises, and a lot of chants. So Melania and Musk kicked it off. You know, Zelensky was part of it with his letter. Democrats played the foil, as Big John does during our hot takes, and the GOP cheered victory. And it wasn't just a speech, people. It was a show with the opening line, America is back. And we're going to break down the moves that just made it all tick. It was actually entertaining. Before we get into specifics here, Armin, what was your first thoughts of that speech?
My favorite part of the speech was, you know, about 15, 20 minutes in, when they were talking about the opposition and Biden administration, how they were throwing all the lawfare and all the crazy stuff out and just took a pause and, you know, says, you know, how'd that work out? I think that was the best thing, that the Democratic Party threw all of this stuff at the evil, terrible, racist Donald Trump, and yet he still got elected. And if all that was even true, what did that say about them? So you kind of hit it right. It was more of a performance. It was more of a show. It was more entertainment. It was not something that was boring to sit through and listen. You know, highlighting, and we can talk about this later, but highlighting just regular folks that are out there, talking about the great work that he's done in 45 days. You know, he didn't need legislation to secure the border. So a lot of strength, a lot of determination, and there's no question as to who the new boss is.
And Annette, your thoughts?
Well, you guys are stealing my words. It's very entertaining. And my favorite part, if we get to say that right now, was when he looked over at the Democrats sitting there and he put his hand out. There's nothing I could do. I could come up with a cure for the rarest disease, you know, and there's nothing I can do to make you people happy. You're just going to sit there with the sourest looks on your faces. And it doesn't matter. Again, he could do something that everyone would agree on, again, cure cancer, and they're not going to be happy. That was actually my favorite part. Well, no, there were some beautiful moments, so I don't want to say that was my favorite part. My favorite part really was some of the other things that were woven into the 100 minutes. But I just thought that was just, he just hit the nail on the head. That's just,
right, right. That's, you know, what he was doing was he was disarming. Our co-host isn't here, Senate, what Ben Shapiro said. I'm like, been there, done that. You know, he disarmed it. He prepared the nation for, hey, you know what? These bozos here, they don't care what I can do, you know. I always forget it, but there's a good joke on the Trump walked on water. You know, they criticized that, you know. And so I thought, I had mixed feelings when I saw him do that. I'm like, he may come across looking petty and just accusing him, but sure enough, that I didn't have a favorite part as much as I had the memorable part, mm-hmm. and that was a total disrespect that the party, and it shows a complete disconnect that they have with America. You may not like Trump, you know, and I deal with people every day. You know, they don't like him. And things he's doing that they like, they still criticize. You can't win for lose with him. It shows how polarizing a figure he is. But contrary to what people are saying, he's gained 20% more black men. He's gained more Latinos. Right now, the mantra with the Democrats is, oh, he's shedding voters. No, he's not. Democrats are good with the topics, as we saw, you know, with the 20-some-odd senators speaking word for word the same thing a few days ago. But so to get this going here, so Trump.
One last thing, William, I want you to say it, but my friend said it really this week. I thought it was so interesting. He goes, I don't like Trump, but I love what he's doing. I think a lot of people, if you have that sentiment as well, it might not be the bravado, the way he can be. It might not be their favorite sort of character, their favorite. He could be a meme, whatever. But this is a person who's been pretty critical of him as a man, but likes what he's doing. And I do think there are a lot of people who feel that way. Like, don't like the guy, but I love what he's doing for the country.
Yep. You know, that's where I was the first year. You know, don't like him, but like what he's doing. But I got so disgusted with people who just hate him. Again, he could walk on water and they criticize that. So I became the supporter. You got to give everybody. And he can be a bully. He's a narcissist. You know, to reach the levels he has business-wise, that's the other thing that cracks me up. So what if he got 10 million, even 100 million from daddy? It's worth billions. The man's a genius when it comes to licensing. Well, all these have gone under these businesses. I go, you're aware that most of those, he licensed his name and the people running the business went under. He collected his and moved on. So, so Melania made her first appearance with him as a first lady in terms of an official event, outside of the inauguration arriving. Mm-hmm. But we also saw the power dynamic and there's no denying it. Elon Musk kind of came in as his sheriff, you know, his right-hand man. That was obvious. He got a standing ovation. They all do. Real quick, what's your take on he's a power guy, loves his red tie. I know this sounds silly, but I look at little nuances and the little things where they're trying to send a message, a subliminal message. I believe in subliminal messaging. I've seen two dictators do it successfully in Panama. What did y'all think of no red tie this time? It was kind of like a blue tie with red patterns on it. Was he trying to send a message or he just going to the closet? Oh, I like this tie. Annette.
I think it's funny you say that because I think those things are intentional. I used to not think that, but recently I was talking to someone about like what people wear and think people in politics and the colors that they choose. I used to think, oh, that's just accidental, or they just think it looks elegant or that looks classy. But no, I think that was intentional.
And before we go to Armin, what message do you think he was trying to convey with that? I guess that's the real question is, I'd say it was intentional, but I have no clue what message he's trying to convey. Annette, quickly, before then we'll go to Armin.
I don't know.
Armin, why, you want to take a crack at it?
Yeah, so, you know, the red tie, the dark red tie, it's powerful, it's out there, you know, some people say, you know, it's blood, it's strength, you know, I'm in
power.
It's power. But the softer colors, it is exceptionally subliminal, and it's not something you think about. But if you look at Trump wearing a bright red tie, dark red tie, on prime time, you know, it's like, I'm coming at you. But the softer, more pastel kind of colors, it's instantly one measure of disarming. And I think you saw that a little bit. I wouldn't be surprised if some of the approval from the speech was due to that. And if I remember right, I think it was about 63-64% of people who approved one of the polls that it was a good speech. That included a lot of Democrats. It said it was a good speech, going back to the point, well, you may not like the man, but the speech kind of held true.
I'll give you a teaser. It was 76% that approved.
There you go. Yeah.
About 20 some odd percent of that.
Do I get to chime in on Melania, or are we going to go to Melania next?
Oh, I was kind of going to skip her here. I did the flow, but go ahead, chime in. The sisterhood has to stick together.
Well, my daughters, you know, and they're very cool and young and in their 20s and middle 20s now, they love her. I mean, she gets like I have five daughters, and she gets a 5 out of 5 rating. So they love her elegance. They love her outfits. They love her beauty. They love her poise. They think she's cool. They love her style. So, yeah.
Yeah, you know, I agree. She's completely transformed from the semi-nude model into the woman she's become. And no, I say that because Democrats, they're always quick to critique. Well, she's a whore. She's a model. This, that, and that.
Right.
She was making an honest living, you know. Armin, it sounds like you want to say something.
Yeah, what's the over-under that she's going to be in the cover of Vogue or Cosmo? I think they may see how popular she is, and I think for no other reason than that she might actually sell magazines.
Sell magazines,
yeah.
Absolutely. That's it. They all sell out for money. Actually
exactly.
Money comes to politics.
All right. So let's move on to I have never according to our producer, she's done of course, you know, John's a libertarian, not the conservative. Gotta get the truth out there. She did an odd nude girl on girl scene, you know. Just for technicalities, full transparency. I actually have never seen. And I'm a sailor, so, you know, it's just, but just full transparency, you know, don't let your girls, Annette, take that to heart now.
Okay, I won't. They just think of her as a first lady. I don't think they've dived very deeply.
They may not have been born when she
did. Exactly.
$1.
Yeah. Okay, so, it may have been done in the past, in the history, I don't know, but in my lifetime, I can't remember. A POTUS pulling out or saying, bring up the executive order, you know, to sign. And that was for the wildlife refuge. He named that after Alexis Nungaray, who was killed by illegal aliens. And, you know, he made a show of it. And that was a showmanship that I thought was coming out. So my question to that is, it was a prop. So was he able to succeed in turning a political, a policy moment there into something personal? And do you think America connected with that? Armin?
There is a reason that Donald Trump is so successful in what he's done. He is a master of marketing. He speaks at a very, very simple level, and it makes Democrats crazy, and Frank, you know, makes some Republicans crazy, but it's what's even crazier is how effective it is. He is a showman. He did The Apprentice. Believe it or not, The Apprentice is one of the things that brought my wife and I together. So we started talking about The Apprentice on the way to a dance, and then, you know, the rest is history. Everything that he did in New York, the buildings that he put in, you know, the Taj Mahal, the risks that he put, he embodies everything about that's risk-taking in America and success. And say what you want, people still respect success. You can talk all you want about we got to tax billionaires and people are too rich and whatever. people still respect success, and that is what he has done. But going back to our earlier point, he's putting on a show. He's moving things around. He's not just sitting there talking. He's taking a physical action. He's, you know, he's signing it, and he's pointing to folks. And then everything about it was a show. It was incredibly effective. I don't know that that's ever happened before.
I don't either. Annette, so do you think he was able to make that an America moment?
No, I have to ask, Armin, you made a really interesting point that not many people talk about. And I listen to a variety of people talking about different things. And the way he talks, you know, like you said, he talks like sort of simplistically, almost like in the elementary school level. Do you know what I mean? Like, that wasn't very nice. Or, you know what I'm saying? He says stuff like that. I'm always like, why does that work? But yet you it does work somehow. And I don't actually can't figure it out because he never strikes me as like, I want to hear someone be very articulate and almost be speaking at an intellectual level. That is not how Trump speaks. But back to what you said, William, I have a little bit of a problem with it, and here's why. Some of these things, you know, naming of this park or, like, the boy who has the cancer, you know what I mean? And they're serious things to me, and I hate that maybe they get yes, they're out there, and he's giving them their due and their attention, and those things do deserve attention. But somehow, for me, it can somehow make it into a little bit of a – can feel a little inauthentic. Do you know, I like authenticity. Some of these things I think are – they're private. People are hurting. Someone went through something really difficult. And to put it out there in those ways – For me, that's a little brash. You know what I mean?
I can see that, but I will push back on this case. Sure. The anger is over for them. They're tired, the family there. It was illegals. They saw Trump do something.
Yes.
And this is a moment her family will never, ever forget. Trump can make it authentic, even if he doesn't really care. I'm not saying he does or doesn't, but he can make it authentic. And the young cancer child, I don't know if you guys saw it, but he got the attention because he's in the ghetto, he's wearing his officers, and a lot of young black girls, they're mocking him, and they're dancing, they're just literally mocking him. And the kid had cancer. That was his, as a child, that he probably will have no greater moment as a child than that. So, and when America saw that, they didn't see Trump. Trump's the sideshow right there. Trump's the showman. You know, welcome to the show, the ring announcer in the circus. But then your moment focuses on the lions, the elephants, the tigers. And that's what these individuals were. I'm not equating them to that. But in essence, it was their moment. America saw them. And I think they related to that. Our producer chimes in, Trump talks to us at a third grade level. Honestly, that's a shot, brother. I get it. But yes, he does.
I agree, John. I agree.
He does. And to give credence for that, when I did my first startup, I researched writing, internet writing. America was at an eighth grade level. Today, they are at a fourth grade level. They don't read. They skim. So, and you're right. I told a lady who's well off, lives in Rancho, I go, I'm uncomfortable around rich people. They're all so poofy too. I go, I'm a brash, uncouth guy. I got to watch every word I say in front of these people. Yet they do everything I had. I said, if I ever was worth $100 million and I got a big old mansion in Rancho Santa Fe, lived next to the social elites, I'd give my welcoming party, that everything's formal. And then when the servers come out, it'd be ribs, you know, grubby ribs where they have to get in dirty their hands. So Trump is a billionaire, but he exudes none of that. And that's why I think America loves him. Remember, before he was president, civil rights leaders wanted their pictures taken with him. Rap singers wrote about him. He was cameo king. He was a star without actually being a star in terms of the traditional way to get it. So, and that is the showmanship in that. Now, the Democrats sat throughout all of it. I gave you guys two events. I thought that was I was angry. And then I thought part of my anger was because they're dissing Trump. But then it hit me. I was angry because you saw – so the individual had cancer, he was a little stunned there, didn't know what to do. And then just out of nowhere, he just grabs and hugs the guy. That's when it hit him.
Yes.
And I think that's where America will look at those Democrats and go, you cold-hearted son of a bitches. Am I wrong to think that, Annette? Then we'll go to Armin.
Oh, you're right. I mean, truly, they're the ones who came off as totally inauthentic for being the party that supposedly has so much compassion. Are you kidding me? I mean, exactly. You're right. That little boy did look sort of shell-shocked. And then he was just sort of like, it was all happening all at once, and the attention was on him, and he didn't know. And then he sort of like, it clicked for him. And then... You know what I'm saying? It was like, it was this spontaneous, beautiful, tearful moment. It was so, that was real. I mean, yeah, Trump, you know, put it out there. I'm just saying, just for me in general, William, these things are, you have to be careful. But Trump is pulling it off. I'm not saying that. And they were beautiful moments, you know, to witness. But the Democrats really come out looking really, really, really like, for people who claim to care, they look so cold. They look so apathetic. It was disgraceful.
Okay, before I don't want to leave this topic too soon, but I'm starting to drag it out here a little bit. So real quick, though, adding to that, and then we'll go to Armin. Sure. Combine what you just said with the fact that Al Green was making the fool of himself there. I think it was obvious to America he was doing it on purpose. He wanted to kick that. It wasn't spontaneous. It wasn't a natural where somebody says something and you're like, no, 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 you're not going to say something. It seemed choreographed. Did that help or hurt the Democrats as well?
Oh, it hurt them for sure. For sure, it hurt them.
Armin, your thoughts on this?
Yeah, you know, when I was watching the speech, obviously the Democrats' behavior was not good, and holding up the sign, this is not true, or and having to pull them up. It's not a good look, and Al Green is not known for saying the smartest things in Congress, and yeah, he was showing it. But I saw that, you know, Congressman Ro Khanna, who's a Democrat, but, you know, fairly reasonable, had somebody chase him down in the airport.
Yes,
says, I'm a Democrat, and which is what you guys did was terrible. You need to do a lot better. The Democrats have done themselves no favors, and they stand for nothing except hate and anger right now. What's going out there. This Trump derangement syndrome has just seeped into so much of their bodies. And now you see the Democratic Party starting to tear itself apart. And the reasonable side, you know, call it the loyal opposition, is finally vocal about calling out the far left progressives, the justice side of communists on this, you know, and racists on the far left. And it is very destructive. It's not healthy for the country.
No, you're right. You're right. I think the problem is the progressives really took over. The last, at least on the Senate side, the last blue collar or blue dog Democrat was from Nebraska. I forget his name. He's gone. Then he died like 6 months after he left the Senate. And they have no more blue dogs. But I think the few that are there realize they got to take the party back, and they got the numbers behind them.
But the thing that bothers me is that, like, when President Trump, for all of the entertainment and all of it, calls out, isn't that when he called Elizabeth Warren Pocahontas?
Yes, we're gonna talk about that. But that's no. Go on with your point.
That's the kind of thing that I think is not the way a president should behave. I'm sorry. There's a certain decorum. There's a certain he needs to not do that.
No, I get you. He made it work because everybody laughed around the country. But that said, he shouldn't have gone down that road.
We're going to go there.
Another prop, the Zelensky letter. Ukraine was on everyone's mind back and forth about the Oval Office. I think that was perfectly planned by him. I got a letter here from Zelensky. He read the letter, and it was nothing but praise. It was Zelensky dropping to his knees, and the only thing he did not say was, I'm sorry, because to be quite honest, no world leader should say that publicly. They need to say that behind the scenes. But he literally said everything but that. And later on, just as a side note, Democrats tried to say, well, he never got that letter. That's what he said on social media. Well, he can send a letter and say the same thing on social media. I thought that was timely. I thought it worked well. I thought that was a selfish moment that worked, not in a bad way, meaning Trump wanted to sit there and say, y'all talking bad about me, but look at the guy who sat there I had to kerfuffle with. He's apologizing to me. Armin, your thoughts?
Well, I have a bit of an issue with this whole back and forth between him and Zelensky. And I don't know if you want to talk more about the actual war, but let's first of all, Trump's idea about the minerals and the economic ties.
Oh, we'll get that to the NATO. Just in essence, yeah. In terms of, because you're right, there are issues with that. But for right now, it's more on Trump using the letter to gain more. Did it work for him to try to show America, hey, look, this guy's apologizing to us?
You know, yeah. I think it worked for him, and it worked for his base and maybe some other parts of America. It didn't really work for me. I don't believe that that was necessarily – I don't believe that that was necessary for him to really kind of rub it in Zelensky's face, so to speak, on a global stage. And we can talk more about that later. But it was a little bit of a bad look, because that did make him look a lot like a bully. The fact that he's getting him to the table is good, but how we actually got there, I'm not so sure that that was constructive.
I get your point. Ron Nearing, who everybody here should know, once mm-hmm. told me in the class, you see that, William, or to the class, you see that little nib on your nail? That's how many of us are actually informed. So from your perspective, you're informed. So you saw it differently. I think that the rest of America, they saw how Trump wanted to. So I see both sides. Annette, your thoughts on that?
I just thought he was gloating. I just think when somebody – that was a very awkward exchange. That was an awkward exchange in the White House. And so Zelensky comes back. He really didn't have a lot of plays on the chessboard with his tail between his legs, sort of, right? And then Trump has to – I wish he would – it was an opportunity to do that, of course, but I wish he wouldn't have taken it.
Right. You know, I got to be honest. I look at it from a couple of perspectives. Mm-hmm. You guys are looking at it analytically, and I agree that. I see and I agree. But that's like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 10% of what the purpose here was. The purpose was, I'm talking to America. I'm representing you. And this is what we got to happen or got to do. And Americans aren't deep into this. They just see the surface. So I think, and not just Trump, Obama's done that. This Bill Clinton would do that. It's funny. You can look at history and see how the charismatic ones are able to pull it off. And the reason I say that is because the thing was, you and that said something earlier. If I or somebody or Armin or you, if we said something like, Trump, dude, are you a racist? Or are you this? Or are you that? Or dude, you're going to, you know, it's like, we can't pull it off. He's one of the few, I believe, who can pull it off. But your points are absolutely correct. However, in this context, that's not what he cared about. He cared about the average Joe and how they were going to take it.
Right. No, I think you're right about that, William. And the average Joe probably maybe didn't dive into the details of what was going on, so they felt good about it.
Yes.
So I see what you're saying. I see what you're saying there. I didn't like it.
Yeah. You know, all the rich people, y'all get at it. No, I'm kidding.
That's not me.
No, I'm just kidding. But yes, I see your point. Okay, give me a comment here on the victory lamp. 100 minutes. Think too long, or do you think he was able to pull it off, Annette?
He kept it moving. I think he pulled it off. I stayed watching it. I watched it more than once.
Nah, there you go, Armin.
Yeah, I wasn't able to watch the whole thing all at once, but you know, I saw most of it in pieces. It was very, very interesting. It's funny. I was actually at one of my local caucuses at the time, so I was doing the business there. But same time, I didn't hear anybody complain that it was too long, except the people who don't like him, and they're going to complain about anything he does.
Yeah, that's true. I was working and I watched these in the back of my head. I'm like, how long has this been going? You know, I knew it was longer, but this is where Trump, the showman. And one, before we move on to the slides here, any final comments on Trump himself in the speech, Annette?
No, it was thoroughly enjoyable from a television perspective, you know, and it also had deep content at times. It was very motivating. It was very uplifting. It was humorous even sometimes. So it had everything.
Right. Okay. And Armin, any final words before we move on to some of this polling of it?
You know, going back to the comment about the nib on the fingernail, and maybe how he's done some of the stuff that he's done in 45 days. But he said, this is what I'm going to do. By golly, he's going out and he's doing it. And it has shocked the living daylights out of everybody, especially.
And right. And I think that's where, like, your friend Annette, there's like, wow, he's actually doing what he's promised. What I noticed here was different. I was angry like Trump. In his first 4 years, you saw that anger in his speeches. This time around, I didn't see the anger. I saw it as the anger was molded into the overall showmanship and what he showcased of himself. So you still saw the anger with, I can walk on water in these Democrats, but it didn't come out as a negative type of anger. So I saw that change. He sees maybe him almost getting killed did change him. You know, who knows? All right, let's move on to some of the polling. So the Arvin pointed out earlier. So I don't want to spend a lot of time on this because, but I think it's important to talk about this. 76% approved of his speech, 23% disapproved. Armin, quick comments on that. Shocking to you? Surprising?
Well, the fact that it was coherent, people could understand him talking compared to the last guy who actually gave a State of the Union address, I'm not surprised whatsoever.
Annette?
Not surprised.
Okay, and the reason I wanted to show this slide first, the 23% disapproved. Remember that.
Okay.
Oh, man, did I kill that? Oh, man, I killed it. Okay, here we go. Okay, I'll go back to the other slide. So 51% of the audience were Republican, 27% were – so 47% were independents and Democrats, 23% disapproved. So he was able to show half of that number. What's that, 14%? John, give me the number there. But at least half of the independents and Democrats, I'm not saying he swayed them over, but half of the people who aren't on his side naturally like the speech. And I think that shows the country starting to look at Trump and they're starting to go, wow, this guy may be able to do something. As Armin, you alluded to, he's doing things. Thoughts on the fact that half of the non-Trump people enjoyed it? Annette?
I think that's exactly like what I told you that I was chatting with my friend about this week, where, you know, he's a guy in banking who is not a fan of Trump but loves what he's doing. So I think a lot of people see that there's activity happening and changes are happening, and they're sort of excited to see what comes next.
Right. So 24% out of the 47% enjoyed it. Okay, so are Trump caring about the issues? 63% say they care, 28% a little, 9% none at all. I shouldn't have put that slide. It's really not that important. I don't think the speech really was
That surprises me. I agree really? With that. That surprised me because I felt like he spent a lot of time, in my opinion, on like the, you know, the sports issue and some of those issues. And I was like, are people that fired up about that? Most people.
I forgot about that. You're right. 80% of the country is against boys playing in female sports. Armin, quick thoughts on this one.
Yeah, I'm not surprised. That the border, kitchen table, you know, jobs through tariffs, really, the reason he won is the kitchen table politics. That is what wins. It always boils down to the simplest things in a campaign and an election.
You know, it's funny. I'm a marketer by trade, so I didn't look at any of the issues. That's why this didn't mean much to me. I saw how he came across as more – how he sold himself. But you guys are right, and these are 80-20 issues, and most of the country's with him, so that makes sense. Okay, let's move on. So this is the one here. 68% felt hopeful, 54% proud. 27 and 16 were on the negative side, worried or angry. So I think, Annette, were you talking about the shots that came in? That's where this may or may not have played into that. Thoughts, Armin, on this one?
Yeah, obviously, if you don't like Trump, you're going to be angry about it. Although you might get some folks who really like the speech might also be angry just at the reaction of the Democrats and what they're seeing as the fight against what Trump is actually trying to do. So it's very possible that he's got some fans in that bottom category.
Could be. All right. The final
one. I want to say something about that.
Oh, I'm sorry. I did I skip you? I'm sorry.
Yeah, you know what? He does this to me, Arnie. Just skips me. I think the most interesting statistic there is the worried. I think that there are some people that are worried. They just might not, they feel unsettled because so much change is happening fast. They don't really know what it means yet. But I think those people could be flipped, is what I'm saying. That was what I was going to say. I think that's an interesting segment of the population, the worried, the people that are worried. And I understand why they're worried, because it's just a lot. Every day there's something happening. And they don't know how to, it's going to be integrated into their lives. Will this affect me? Will it not? They don't know.
Okay. Well, you know what? I'm worried. You know, they're worried about egg prices. If the last administration hadn't killed all those chickens, we wouldn't have that problem. All right. Okay. So this one here is presidential, entertaining, inspiring, unifying, divisive. I thought this hit it on the head because he was all of that. This is what makes Trump unique. But you put Bush in there. Would there be entertaining, inspiring, unifying, divisive, or Biden? No, none of that. You know, and even Obama wouldn't be entertaining. They would say something like politically correct. Oh, he was inspiring, you know, a presidential. But Trump is able to cover them all. So I thought this was spot on. Annette.
I think it is too. Actually, I think about Obama, they'd say that he was eloquent. You know, he was a very, very eloquent speaker. But this does not surprise me one bit.
Armin.
Yeah, I agree with Annette. If you look at those first three categories, they very closely parallel the approval for the speech. But what's most interesting is look at that 46% category. That means that some of the people who did approve of the speech, did like it, also found it divisive, and maybe they're okay with that.
Like Annette alluded to, there were the spots where it was obviously divisive there, and Trump can't help himself. But if I'd been speechwriter, I said, "I know you want to say it, boss, but let's not say it tonight." All right. Yeah. So Trump's address was a masterclass in theater. Melania Musk framed the start. The props, they hit the mark. They hit the heart. Zelensky's letter stunned the Democrats, I'm sure, because they thought they had something to go on. And Democrats stumbled into his trap. I thought they played into looking bad. The 100 minutes wore everyone down, I think, by the end. But the victory chant, that turned it into kind of like a rah-rah. It was just a different energy. And because it's Trump, it was able to work. This wasn't just a policy dump, as other presidents have done, but a performance that owned the room and over 76% of Americans approved. And that's the raw truth of how it went.
I've got a quick question for you, William and Armin. Do you guys think that if it had been an official State of the Union, he could have done that same kind of performance?
Well, it all depends. If it's a State of the Union and the economy's going well, yeah. This was a State of the Union just because it's only 45 days. They named it differently. But if the economy's going well, yeah, he's going to be like that. If it's not going well, then, you know, he may go on.
Could it be less decorum because it wasn't really an official State of the Union? I'm more asking you about, you're right, it had that rah-rah feel to it.
No, that's what I'm saying. Yes, in a State of the Union, if the economy's doing well, we get the same speech next time. If
Got
it's
it.
Not, then look for a different one.
Got it. Okay.
Okay. So let us talk, or let's take a hard look at the breaking point. The U.S. is $37 trillion in debt. We are going to talk here U.S. and Ukraine, fallout and the ugly truth, and where do we stumble, or rather, where does Europe stumble next? Ukraine's clinging to our cash and intel. Trump slamming the brakes, and NATO's creeping east while Russia fumes. There's no heroes here, people. There's just ugly truths, and we're asking, where do we stumble next in terms of do we continue to fund money? Do we continue to argue and fight with Zelensky, or do we get this peace deal done? So the reality of everything is we are, again, $37 trillion in debt. Not quite, like 36 point something. And that is up. We're paying $1.1 trillion in interest. And that's more than what we pay for Medicare. That's more than what we pay for defense. If you break that down to every citizen, that's $110,000. That's more than I earn. You know, the interest alone could fund the Ukraine war twice over. And Ukraine, they've gotten $175 billion since 2022. There's no repayment. Unlike Europe, Europe's getting a good chunk of that repaid, and we're not. So we want their minerals to earn back some of this. This is also on top of the fact we pay over $500 billion a year in NATO to defend Europe. So we spent all this money. Meanwhile, we have crumbling bridges. And I thought this analogy or example, we, with $125 billion, we can fix all our bridges. So all the money we're sending to Ukraine, we could have used here to actually have improved America. I mean, at this point, what's better for us, war overseas or taking care of America? Armin, as a retired captain, I'm sure you probably have some insight in this in terms of the way you think, especially if you haven't gone to the war college.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's take a look at the shipbuilding industry in this. And this kind of explains your analogy of $125 billion fix all the bridges. So we could throw $125 billion and say, hey, let's buy all the ships we need. We can't do it. We don't have the physical infrastructure. We don't have the labor skills. We don't have a lot of what we need to do it. And this is a big, big problem right now, is that the Congress, in fact, is not funding the Navy to its shipbuilding requirements simply because they know that Huntington Ingalls and Bath Iron Works can't build the ships as fast as they possibly can. A student of history, you know, I get it. We don't want to fight foreign wars if we can avoid it. And, of course, the best way to avoid a war is to win it before a first shot is actually fired. The fact that Russia invaded Ukraine and the fact that Hamas attacked Israel, and you want to throw in the, I can't even say, botched withdrawal from Afghanistan, is a case point in why the last 4 years was just so horribly damaging to us and the rest of the world. But having said that, there are bad actors in the world that are rational and irrational, and you've just got to be ready for it. And the danger of too much of a peace dividend or throttling back, and believe me, there are places to save money in the Defense Department. That is a whole other podcast if you want to talk about it. I can give you some experiences that would make your blood curdle. But we've got to be ready. We are the leader of the world, and just by nature of us being the freest nation in the world, that's where we are. I don't know that that's going to be true 10 years from now. I think it could very well be China. So if we don't want to be second fiddle to China, then we've got to change how we're doing. And even Trump, for all what he's done, isn't nearly strong enough or hard enough on them, for my taste.
Right. Okay, Annette, your thoughts on that. And now, he used an analogy there that's true. My analogy was different, though. It deals with civilian. We do have the people that build our roads, that build these bridges, to do that. But we only have a handful in Connecticut and out here in San Diego, and those are yards. So who knows, you know? And it takes forever to build ships, and they tend to have cost overruns. That's just a whole nightmare unto itself. And you can just look back at Reagan's 700 Fleet Navy in terms of how contracts are so poorly created. So yeah, Armin, that's absolutely true. But I'm referring more on the civilian side. You know, taking care of everything from our potholes to our bridges to our infrastructure in our city. I mean, that's a lot of money we could have used in those places. Armin, you wanted to chime in before we go?
Yeah, I just wanted to say, the analogy actually holds true. There may be more of a capacity, but even then, you could throw all the money in the world at it. I mean, even here in San Diego County, we have a lot of infrastructure problems. You could throw all the money in the world, and it's going to take you a very long time to catch up, because there's just not enough of that capacity to actually do it and train up.
I get that, but shouldn't we be, this money would help to build, get that going, to get the infrastructure, to get the building going. What I'm saying is, why send the money over there when, hey, we could use this money to start building? Like, for example, Trump's trying to bring manufacturing back. I do believe militarily we cannot be outsourcing that stuff. In essence, you're outsourcing our secrets, our technology, the rare earth minerals that China gives us. They've already cut that off. You know, so my take is that's, you're giving me an even validating my belief even more. Keep the money here, start rebuilding, and do what's needed to be able to get our shipyards to build the ships. Annette, your thoughts?
I'd like to ask Armin a question. Armin, what happens, because I tend to agree with you on this, William, what happens if we just pulled out? What if we just did not have any money going to Ukraine? What is the scenario that you envision?
If we didn't help Ukraine, like I said, you know, the fact that we had to do it is a failure on U.S. foreign policy. Mm-hmm. But to allow Russia to basically run roughshod through Ukraine, and I don't think that the Europeans would have been able to stop. I mean, it might have taken a while, but I think Russia probably would have gotten to Kyiv without the U.S. help. then the U.S. now becomes a lesser power and a less reliable ally, both in peace and in conflict. And that translates to
how do you put that together? That doesn't
hold on. So we jumped the shark, but that's good. I'm just gonna when I mean that I'm gonna just jump ahead.
Sure.
And I'm gonna put this map first. So this map is the incursion of NATO. Remember, and we talked about this in the podcast already. Mm-hmm. I'm already forgetting. When Stalin and Roosevelt met, there was the unwritten statement they weren't. The Allies wouldn't push towards Russia.
That's right.
Spreading. It wasn't a document, but it is. They do have the proof when East and West Germany were reuniting, they told Gorbachev.
There was an agreement. That's correct.
Not going to push eastward. So to me, Armin, it's not about Russia running roughshod. It's about Russia looking at the bigger picture and the encroachment on theirs. And then I'm going to go back to the Cuban Missile Crisis. We almost went to World War III against Russia because they were going to put missiles in Cuba. Somebody says, well, it was nuclear. It doesn't matter if it's a pea shooter or a nuclear. Superpowers do not want their enemy in their backyard that close with striking distance. And this is the incursion that I'm talking about. So if you look here at the NATO alliance, you'll see the years, and then you'll see the color as NATO encroaches eastward. Now, remember the promise that we made to Russia, and we are not Russian defenders here. We're more truth tellers in terms of winding the truth out here. 91, 92, boom, okay, they all get free. Russia fall. Russia says enough, we're invading. Now, I also want to show this. This is 1997, Biden talking about, hey, it doesn't matter if these countries are ready to come in. The one thing that's going to piss Russia off is if we start annexing these Baltic states. They are not going to like that at all. Meaning, in all that blue, those were Baltic states.
I thought there was one other piece of unfinished business you said earlier in your discussion.
Oh, I'm sorry. This is 1997. So we're not talking just a few years ago. This has been on the table from Russia warning us since then.
Well, what about the Baltics? Well, what about the Baltics? If you could tell us what their prospects are for expansion.
What about the Baltics? What are their prospects? Their prospects are real but more distant. And I think this is me and only me speaking. Not speaking for the administration.
That was the Clinton administration at the time.
Or anyone else in the United States Congress. And I obviously, to state the obvious, I could be dead wrong about this. I think the one place where the greatest consternation would be caused in the short term for admission, having nothing to do with the merit and preparedness of the country to come in, would be to admit the Baltic states now in terms of NATO-Russian, U.S.-Russian relations. And if there was ever anything that was going to tip the balance, were it to be tipped in terms of a vigorous and hostile reaction, I don't mean military, in Russia, it would be that.
Now, he was wrong. It turned out to be military. I got one more to show. This is, well, if we do this, we may push Russia into China and maybe even Iran. And this is Joe Biden saying you're stupid if you think that. He doesn't say that, but that's in essence what he's saying.
Where do they go? I had one interesting comment. Our conversation was Zaganov, which was repeated with Levin. They talked about they don't want this NATO expansion. They know it's not in their security interest and on and said, well, and if you do that, we may have to look to China. And I couldn't help using the colloquial expression from my state by saying to Zaganov, lots of luck in your senior year. Good luck. And if that doesn't work, try Iran. I'm serious. I said that to them, and these were and they know, I knew, they knew, everybody knows that that is not an option. And everybody knows, every one of those leaders.
So what he's saying is, y'all have no option. You're not going to go to China. You're not going to go to Iran. You got to deal with us. It was the brazenness. Now, I got to say this. Joe Biden has been is seen as 40 years of ignorance and stupidity with his foreign policy. I think these are the type of takes they're referring to. But Armin, I'll go to you because Annette asked you the question. But at the end of the day, they were warning us from that point, and we had made promises. And to me, I always disagree, and I dispute it with Big John. America, the bully. I'm like, we're not bullies. That's just how life works. This was America being a bully to its current detriment now. Because right now, so to me, this wasn't Russia. Hey, we're going to invade because we want to expand. Maybe it was. But based off all the data, all the analytical data out there, this was something they kept warning and warning, except the difference here, unlike us in 62, we were able to push the Soviets back and not to install these missiles. We were brazen enough and just kept going and going, and Russia said enough. Armin, I know you don't quite agree with that, so what are your thoughts?
Well, I mean, think about Russia in the 1990s, post-Cold War, coming down. You had Gorbachev, and then you had Yeltsin come in. Russia was very, very weak, yes. And a lot of those countries that have been living under the Soviet yoke for a very long time, they wanted freedom, they wanted an alliance, they wanted to be working directly with the West. They aligned themselves more philosophically with the West, and they were looking for a military alliance because they didn't trust Russia. They said, well, they may be gone today, but they could be coming back tomorrow, and we want to make sure that we're a bulwark. Now, you heard what Biden was saying, but at the same time, Russia, if you don't threaten your neighbors, you don't have anything to fear from us. And then we saw in 2007, they go into Georgia, and then after that happened.
Hold on. Quick pushback. He went into Georgia after Bush said, we foresee Georgia and the Ukraine becoming members of NATO. That was actually, Putin had just told him, no, they're not going to be. And they came back, oh, yes, we do foresee that. And Putin was sending a message, I'm going into Georgia. Y'all need to stay out. So that was predicated, again, by U.S. diplomatic policy. And my point is, why are you looking to pick a fight? If forced, in his mind, they felt we got to – when you got all of Europe and America, and you're now just Russia, you're no longer the Soviet Union. What I'm saying is, from their perspective, they may have seen it differently. So you're using Georgia as Russia being the aggressor. And I'm saying I don't quite see it like that based off the diplomacy that was being pushed by NATO at the time. And I apologize, Armin. I'm going to get back to you.
But,
you want to chime in here?
No, I want to know what Armin's going to say about it, because I think that we were provoking them unnecessarily.
I don't think so, because you also had the separatists or so in Georgia that were aligning themselves with Russia, and that's what Russia ostensibly came in as the excuse they used to say, well, you're repressing these people and we're going to come and do it. So maybe you can call it chicken and the egg, whatever you want, but at the same time, if Russia hadn't done that, they basically was a self-fulfilling prophecy. Oh, they are a big enemy, they are a big bully, they are coming in. They had no reason to do that. Russia could have said, hey, look, we don't really want you on our borders, but there's maybe something else that we can do. But they were very hostile about it.
Well, hold on, though. So we have to tell every country, go piss off. We will go to war. Don't go come to our borders. But we're telling Russia, hey, you're going to have to live with us on your borders. And my point is, that's quite an American way of thinking of it. I'm an American, and I'm looking at the bigger picture. What could we have done to have avoided it? And my whole point is we should never have entered the Baltic area. But you're right. Russia has a history. I was researching it today. They have a deep history of that, going back to hundreds and hundreds of years of invading these territories. So these countries did have a legitimate issue. But Armin is right. And Big John is right with the term bully, in terms of it was Russia. It was no longer the Soviet Union. It was Russia. That whole area was down. Remember, we were sending them wheat. We made the mistake that we made with China in the 90s when they said, oh, once we introduce democracy, they're going to love capitalism and they're going to come to our side. And even as a child, I said this in a previous podcast, I'm like, no, they're going to take everything from capitalism to make themselves richer, more powerful, and they're going to remain authoritarian, or in China's case, communistic. So I'm like, I'm a freaking 12-year-old kid. How the hell do I see this and these damn morons don't?
And that's a whole other podcast there, and the corruption of how China and Russia and how politics work. But I don't think our point is the data is there. The history is there. And I will go as far as saying this. We are as guilty as those who are claiming Russia. Not to mention, Armin, just real quick on your thoughts, because I want to get into another topic because we're nearing our point. But your thoughts on the 2014 coup that it's pretty much out there that, hey, it was our CIA helped with that coup, and Virginia and Ireland was deep and heavy in that for the simple fact that their duly elected government was more aligned with Russia, and they were actually working in terms of turning over Crimea to Russia. Now, whether we like it or not, they were elected by the people, and we didn't went in and overthrew that government. You know, and to me, that's kind of like the trigger. All bets are off the table. If I'm Russia, if they're going to go in and overturn the government, all bets are off. So I am defending not their invasion, but at the fact when they go, all bets are off. Hey, maybe we shouldn't have done that coup. Now, my whole country of Panama, I've told the world many times, was created because of American imperialism, Panama, you know, for the canal. I mean, that's the bottom line. In this case, it was I don't know I can't pin down one specific reason, but my whole point is we shouldn't have been there. There was everything to lose, nothing to gain, and that everything to lose is being seen through this Ukrainian invasion. Your thoughts on the coup?
Well, you know, the U.S. has mixed results in its history when it comes to coups. You look at, Iran with Mossadegh. You look at, you know, we talked about Panama. Let's look at, I had another example in my head, and it just evaporated. So, and you have to make the best decisions you have based on the information that you have at the time. And with a government in Ukraine that was friendly to Russia, I don't really remember the circumstances that happened right before that. So you might have a little bit of disadvantage at that point. But, you know, the U.S. is certainly not perfect. But I think you and I do agree at the very least that a lot of these things can be stopped with proper diplomacy and proper relations. And this war with Ukraine never should have happened in the first place.
Right. Biden wanted this war. They had I forget what the treaty was called, 2022. It was on the table. Russia was like, just say you're not going into NATO. Say you'll be a neutral company. And you keep all your lands. And Zelensky, well, hold on. I haven't cashed out yet. Nope, can't do that. I'm being facetious. All right. So let's get into what's on hand right now. People are screaming bloody murder because Trump has stopped our intel sharing, which has resulted in 80% of drone loss. They may know where the Russians are at, but they can't see them, you know, and that's devastating when it comes to war. On top of that, they're already kidnapping young men and older men to conscript them. My belief is simple. Also, the military aid has stopped. Everything stopped. Trump has put a stop in everything. It has Europe scrambling. The problem with Europe, for example, Germany just has no relation to Ukraine, but their power, they have like 9 subs. 6 of them have been in the yard for the last 10 years. 3 of them just aren't operational, meaning they have no ability to carry out anything long term. So they're really hammering Trump because 200 people died because Russia saw, y'all are blind. We're going in. You know, now my point is this, death is horrible. But at the end of the day, if he forces Zelensky to the table, he's ending a forever war of another 2, 3, 4 years of hundreds of thousands. I'm not saying those are acceptable. I'm saying this is on Zelensky. He did not want to come to the peace table because there's no way, and I, my producer, we talk about this, so that's why I mention him a lot. There's no way to the spoils goes the whatever that saying is. Russia's taking those lands. They're not giving it back. No different than the Golan Heights in the 66th War of Israel when they were attacked by 6 people. That's something that's just how life is, and it's not fair. They can negotiate some things, but Zelensky's high on coke, as they say, if he thinks he's getting everything back. And that's what he's trying to stand on, the moral ground, and I don't think he has that ground to stand on. Your thoughts on where we stand politically at this moment with the intel stopping, the foreign aid stop, and where Europe's at, Armin?
Yeah. So I agree with you that this war needs to come to an end. I would probably say instead of Trump making Zelensky look like a bad guy, he should have made Biden look like the bad guy. Because if we had actually gone in full bore once Russia had stopped, then we would be having a completely different conversation right now. Russia wouldn't hold anywhere near as much territory as they do right now. So I think the fact that Russia has advanced as far as they can, and Russia has shown they have the willpower to fight the war, even though they didn't necessarily have the wherewithal, whereas we are the wherewithal but don't necessarily have the willpower. Look at the amount of artillery shells Russia's spitting out, vice the United States. Ukraine is not going to push them back. I could have, you know, instead of maybe making Zelensky say, you don't want to come to peace, say, hey, look, my predecessor didn't do everything we can for you. This war is going to go on forever. And even if we give you all the weapons that you want, you're not going to be able to kick them out. So, absolutely.
Well, I think he's trying to say that. Armin, he has tried to say that. And then Trump said, y'all wouldn't last without our help. He said, well, that's what Putin said. And I think Trump's saying, okay, let's see how it's doing. And my issue is this, and I searched this out. Yeah. Bakhmut's tomb. That was years of fighting. That's a city. There's nothing left there in that Ukrainian-Russian part. It is devastated. It no longer exists. And I personally believe Russia is just entrenched. They're sitting. They're biding their time because they know the Ukrainians don't have enough manpower. And they know we're $37 trillion. They know something's got to give. And they know Europe doesn't have the ability.
Yeah, they will.
Yeah, exactly. So I think Russia's just waiting it out. People who say, look, they've held Russia back this long. I think Russia doesn't look at the timetable. One thing that has always pissed me off are analysts in history. Korea, oh, we'll get in there and we'll take care of that in this time frame. Vietnam in this time frame. You know, Afghanistan in this time frame. You know, so it's like you all are idiots. You don't think the enemy's not going to fight back. And so those who sat there said, oh, Russia's going to be done with this in 3 weeks or 3 months. I'm like, no, this is Ukrainians' land. They're going to dig in and do the best they can. Then if we arm them, it's going to continue. But that said, I think Russia prepared for this and they're just camping out, you know, but without the 80% of intel, the Ukrainians are sitting ducks. Annette, your thoughts on that? And I'm going to toss the final question in before we move on, and I'll add this in with you, Annette. Your thoughts on
I thought that was very good, William. I really agree with what you're saying. I think Russia is in it for the long game. I think they're just like when you they're totally content to just sit it out, and they have the, you know, they have the will to do it. So I don't disagree with anything that you said. I guess I don't think because you summed it up rather well, and I think you and I agree on what's happening there. I just still am curious what Armin thinks. I just want you guys to present, you know, diplomatically, strategically thinking, Armin, a worst case scenario. We stopped funding it, which then we know shortens the shelf life for Ukraine. If there's not a peace that comes to the table, and I actually did hear before the show tonight that Zelensky just said, I want peace. I don't know if that just happened. I saw that. But worst case scenario, if we are not supporting this anymore as Americans and we are focusing more, let's say, inward, like, you know, William was saying, yeah, by the way, why do our trains and our transportation sucks? But, what happens to Ukraine? Even in a worst-case scenario, let me ask you this, Armin. Let's say Russia, you know, that's a territory they get back for their territory. Is that a terrible thing for the United States? Just present a worst-case scenario for me so I understand it.
If Russia, well, at this point, Russia is going to basically hold most of the territory they're in right now. And I think this minerals deal is Zelensky's way to get off gracefully. If, you know, by pulling out, you know, I think the Europeans are going to start ponying up a lot more. And, you know, who are talking about Russia is just going to wait all this out. They have gotten their asses kicked. They just happen to have a lot more stuff to throw into this morass than Ukraine actually does. So while Russia is waiting out, I think they're exuding some bravado right now, says, hey, we got the upper hand. But internally, I think they realize that because they're putting 30% of their economy into this war effort right now, they will not be able to sustain it over a long period of time. And in every war and every conflict, you come to a point of, say, maximum advantage, or I'm not going to get any far. So it's like, this is as far as I've gotten. I'm going to get pretty much everything I want. I shouldn't get greedy, so I should stop. So I don't see Russia basically going much further into Ukraine without much more severe cost. So I think
what about help from China?
No, China's not going to get involved in that.
China is not really an ally of love. They're just a convenient ally. Russia would be like the last people China takes over in their minds.
They're giving them drones and stuff, but they're not going to give them people. They're not going to.
I'll push back on this. My issue is we're getting these death numbers from the UN, and the UN's getting a lot of their death numbers from Russia's side, from the Ukrainian Ministry of Defense. So to me, we had no clue how much Russia has a loss in men. And here's the other thing. Historically, nobody beats the Russians in the long game. I mean, nations have tried. The French have tried. The Germans have tried. You know?
Let me just push back a tiny little bit on Armin, because I just went to a talk this week by someone who's an expert in China, lived there, and Gordon Chang. I was at his talk this week, and he basically said that he thinks that China would support the war in Russia. He thinks that they are in a situation right now of desperation in their country in terms of, you know, the economy is so bad, and that they're ready and willing to get into a conflict. And they're almost like they sort of, and he's losing his power. I'm sorry, I never say his name right, the leader of China. He's in a position, and he wants to double down, and he will get involved in a conflict like that because they need to make a move. I guess war is more profitable than I ever realized.
Yes, war is profitable.
It is a profitable business.
Yeah. We can talk about China because that's a whole – we're going to be here for another 20 minutes.
But I'm just saying that he made it sound like that was a real possibility. That's all I'm saying.
Putin did?
No. Gordon Chang, at the talk I went to, was an expert on China, made it sound like him getting involved and them supporting Russia to stay their ground was a real possibility.
Yeah, but as Armin said, that could be with drones, could be other ways, but they're not going to get heavily involved. This isn't their fight, and they have no reason to, because Russia's going to win this, especially with us with us pulling out, you know. All right, so okay, before I close it out, Armin, because I know we don't agree on this, so any final words before I close it out?
You talked a lot about our national debt, $36, $37 trillion. I want to point out to everybody, you know, we had a deficit in $1.9 trillion in 2024. If you look at our GDP, that deficit represented all of the growth that we had in 2024 and probably a little bit more. Our economy is not in good shape. All of the growth that you're seeing right now is all borrowed spending, and we have borrowed 8 years, 9 years of growth going forward. So whether it's transfer payments to Ukraine, whether it's fraudulent payments for Medicare and Medicaid, whether it's the waste in the Department of Defense, it doesn't matter. And people could be upset that Trump is cutting his jobs back and pulling all this money back. This debt is an existential threat to our nation. It is more dangerous than anything that the Russians or anybody else can throw at us. We have got to balance our budget and get our books in order. I think we are actually probably past the point of no return. The question is how much long-term damage has been done?
I can't argue with that. I do wonder if we're at the point of no return. Because look at the Democrats. They're trying to hide the grift, the spending. They wanted to continue. You know, the Keynesian economics, you know. It's anyway, so to everybody. Oh, looks like we lost Annette there. When she comes back here, we'll go ahead and pop her in. So Trump's a bastard to some. But with the $37 trillion debt, as Armin just stated, it's crushing us. Ukraine is blind and cracking without our aid. NATO's map creeping east. And while critics are talking about saving lives here and there, as bodies pile up, there are no heroes here. It's just simple math. And Ukraine cannot sustain this. Trump says kneel to Ukraine. And that map we showed you shows why Russia's pissed. So who's going to own this mess? We're going to wait and see. But hopefully peace is on its way. All right. Let's go to our final segment here, Hot Takes. And Armin, looks like it's just me and you. Big John, if you want to jump on, feel free. But maybe try to connect with Annette there on IRC there and see what's happening. Oh, hold on. Maybe she just connected. Oh, okay. So Annette will be back shortly. She's having some technical difficulties. Big John is here. So Armin, this is our Fired Up Hot Takes. I asked the question. And you give your opinion on it. So what we hope doesn't happen, it becomes – so last night, our good friend Hody, John said, you got 2 minutes to answer. Hody said, I don't need 2 minutes. 4 minutes later, you know. Yeah. So just to give you an idea. So Question number one deals with Trump's $3 trillion boast, economic genius, or gilded fantasy. And this breaks down to he's bringing in companies to invest in America. AOC said, no, that's a lie, that's a lie. And she kind of put it on it's going to be the government spending the money, not realizing that I think that it's a company bringing their money and manpower, et cetera. So is Trump's $3 trillion investment plan for the American economy brilliant and needed move, or is this just, as AOC says, a reckless fantasy? John?
Well, I'm a firm believer that the government doesn't create anything. The only thing it can do with the economy is hurt it. So is the government creating anything? No. All they're doing is maybe picking a political favorite class, a favorite political class, and allowing them to compete openly. So I tend to find it very dubious that I think he's creating anything.
Oh, I'll answer then. You can. Not at all. And here's why. The chip company from Taiwan is coming here. And they're coming here, I think, for various reasons. But they have chips here. There's no tariffs. They save money. We get more jobs. And that's just one of us. So he's bringing manufacturing back until these companies unionize, and then they go back to their countries. Armin, your thought?
Big John is right. Government does create jobs, but they're all federal jobs. They're all, you know, government-paid jobs. But government is responsible for creating a conducive environment through which jobs can be created, where risk can be taken, and, you know, the cost of business is brought down. And, you know, I don't know that we necessarily need to cut taxes so much. Just reduce the cost of doing business. Make it cheaper to do business in this country. Bring in all that investment in the United States, that AI, that chip making. I can't tell you how important that chip making is to do in the United States. It is absolutely vital. So hopefully you can continue to build this positive environment to bring more foreign investment to the U.S.
All right. Okay, so let's move on then. Question number two. All right, perfect, Annette. So Trump's master plan is back to the cotton fields we go, says the genius duo. Hank Johnson says about Trump and his economic policies, it's a recipe to make education unavailable to black people. It puts us back to when America was great and we were picking cotton and doing the productivity they're putting my Latino brothers and sisters who migrate. Just for the record, Hank Johnson is the dumbest man to have ever heard office. He thought if there were too many people on one side of Guam, it would tip over. True story. Go look at him. But he's telling that to an admiral. Now, the newest hero, Jasmine Crockett, says, working the fields, those immigrants that come into our country work the fields, something that we ain't done in a long time. So when she said it's okay for us to work the fields, but blacks can't work the fields. To me, this is nothing but nonsense, and they're trying to create the tribalistic divide. So the question is, do Crockett and Johnson genuinely believe that tying Trump's policies to a return to slavery will resonate and persuade Americans, or are they so detached from the mainstream political discourse that they fail to see this is now seen as hyperbole? And I'll add this. Trump has got 20% more black men to support him since the election. Let's start with you, Miss Annette.
You're so funny. You love to give the answers in your questions sometimes. Yeah, right. I don't think this tactic is going to work at all. As a matter of fact, I think it'll anger a lot of people.
Armin.
Oh, I'm sure they fully believe it, but they're living in their own echo chamber. I mean, you got school boards here in California that are reducing standards in those lower income areas, and they are creating this inequity that they are decrying so much. It is an absolute crime, is what's happening.
You're right.
Yes.
The schools are run by Democrats. Big John.
So is your question specific to do I think they're right, or do I think that what they're doing is the tactics they're using?
Well, they actually believe they're BS is really pretty much what the question
no,
is.
No, of course not. No, I don't believe they're BS, but we live in the age of Trump, as you pointed out, and a lot of people think by saying outrageous, stupid things, they're going to be as successful as Trump is. So they're trying to tactic. They're not as good at it, as you said, as Trump. That's all there is to it, but yeah, it's nonsense.
Well, not to mention Trump can rattle off everything he's done for black Americans since his first statistically. All right, so let's move on from trailblazing hero to whiny hypocrite. You know what? You're right in it. I do have a bias, but it's my show.
No, I love it. I love it. I wasn't criticizing.
So from trailblazing, I'm reading my question. I'm like, yeah, that's biased. from trailblazing hero to whiny hypocrite, how one guy nailed greatness, then top victimhood 101 and flunk role model 201. I am referring to, and Armin, I'm going to start off with you here. So the general who was running the Virginia Military Institute was, you're fired, because he was promoting DEI initiatives. He called America oppressors. He blamed America and Israel for Hamas's attack. He championed and he was pushing diversity. He accused people of racially targeting, and so they let him go. My question refers to, so did the VMI superintendent deserve to be fired and abuse his role with woke policies, or was he just doing his job? And I want to add to that, and why would somebody like him, who had to work hard and overcome so much through hard work, teach victimhood? Armin.
You know, it's really tragic. And I need to caveat something. You know, what DEI is and what some people perceive it as, you know, DEI, in my opinion, doesn't include things like, you know, minority recruiting or giving opportunity to folks who otherwise didn't have it. I believe in equal opportunity. I think the way the Democrats are portraying it is they're rolling it all up together, when in fact, I don't believe that that's actually the case. This victimhood and this divisiveness, I mean, I have seen DEI in action, you know, in a lot of places I don't want to really go into specifically, and the effect that it actually has on people, and they actually believe that, you know, every racial disparity or every disparity that exists because two people of different skin color is due to racism, is dangerous, it is damaging, and it basically absolves an individual personal responsibility for bettering themselves. So that is not a message we need to be telling anybody. But, you know, when you put someone's responsibility for their own well-being on their own shoulders, you will be shocked and amazed as to what people can actually accomplish and what they are able to do with themselves. And right. I think that is something that we have, that is an art that has been lost.
I agree. I saw that true biography there with Eddie Murphy rising to become a stock guy.
Yeah.
Trading places. Okay. So Big John, Armin says, I don't deserve my 2 mules and 40 acres. What's your take?
Well, you know, there's a lot. I think there's, you know, I believe in pendulum swinging, right? So, like, on the one end, like, there was the push for what's termed DEI, like Armin said, as opposed to minority recruiting or minority empowerment. There's differences, right? And equality of opportunity is different from equality of outcome. So I get the resistance to that. But I also think we're falling into a trap now where the response to anything is, well, that's a DEI hire. That's a DEI policy. You're woke. You're woke. Like, how
you're
many
right,
of us – wait. Let me finish. How many of us don't think we're woke? How many of us? Because we believe in what we believe in, and we're woke to our own ideologies, right? So, you know, I'm woke to I want everybody to be free, right? So that's my wokeness. So it's not – the woke itself is not a negative term. We're using it that way. So to answer your question, should he have been fired? Yes.
No, we're not using it that way. It's become that way because, as Armin said, that's what the Democrats have turned it into. So there's a very distinct difference to that. And as far as woke, my life experiences, as Armin said, hey, throw it on your shoulders. Nobody helped me. And I surprisingly did a few things that nobody will ever take away from me because of what he said. So I agree with what you're saying in the general sense, but boy, do I disagree with your points. But John and I always disagree. So, Annette, I want my 2 mules and 40 acres, damn it.
No, John agreed with you in the end, right, John?
I did, yes, but never let that get in the way.
Black and white because of the fact that he has said and has pushed these policies, not from the DEI, as Big John and Armin are stating, but more from the racial perspective. Because DEI technically isn't supposed to be about black only. You know, that's what they kind of made it. Annette, your thoughts?
I want to believe that some of these policies were really put into place because people cared about other people and wanted to give them opportunities. I want to believe that. And then after seeing the Democrats sit on their hands at the State of the Union, I'm not sure I believe that they care about much of anything. I just feel like, yeah, he should have been fired. There's no question. I don't have a question about that. But, like, and also I think some of these things, good intentions behind them. But the, but the road to hell was paved with good intentions.
Good point. Good point. And you're right. You're right. Wanting to give somebody a leg up who's earned it that doesn't have the opportunity is one thing. But giving it to them without having earned it or showed the proof leaves somebody else. And even then, if you give it to somebody, say, who's black or Latino who hasn't earned it, well, I'm sure there's a black or Latino who has busted their tail who's being left behind. You know, and that does nothing but depress them even more. All right. I think I know I'll agree with Big John on this one. Exit stage left Zelensky, the comedian president, to get booted like a vaudeville flop over Ukraine's leadership drama. Boy, these sound better in my mind when I make them up. You know, Trump is talking to the opposition in terms of, hey, your boy Zelensky's not coming to the table here. What else you got? So the question is, should Trump's team support emergency elections in Ukraine to oust Zelensky, or is it U.S. meddling in a war zone? Yes or no, go. I want to answer this one first, only because I think it's 2014. You know, look at the mess we did when we ousted one democracy. The Ukraine people have to decide who they want. And eventually they'll realize Zelensky's doing nothing but creating more chaos and more deaths. So I understand Trump's anger, and but I think we need to keep our let them send who they want to represent us. Annette,
it's a hard no for me. I don't think we should get involved. And also, I just wanted to say, because I didn't get to say it because I had to scurry to the bathroom, I wanted to say how really, really, and I'm sure you guys feel the same way, profoundly sad that war makes me. Like, what is that saying? One man dying is a travesty, and a thousand men dying is a statistic or something. I just think all these people's lives, they matter, and they deserve a chance to live them out. And to me, there's almost nothing that is worth going to war for. Almost nothing. I mean, I know it happens sometimes, but it really should be.
It's a last resort.
Thank you.
John.
So is the question, should we meddle in their?
Exactly. The question is, should Trump's team support emergency elections in Ukraine to oust Zelensky, or is U.S. meddling in the wars?
They should not be meddling in at all. And it's also important to keep in mind that according to the Ukrainian constitution, my understanding is that Zelensky's doing nothing wrong. Like, he, during wartime, they can't.
He can impose martial law, right. But he can kidnap or conscript or put.
Right. I was talking about the elections themselves. Yeah. So canceling elections is perfectly legal in the Ukraine during wartime. So in either case, it should be none of our business at all.
I wouldn't say none of our business. I would say that we need to keep hands out, but he should know that we're happy with somebody else to the Ukraine people. Wink, wink, you know, but stay out of it. Armin, your thoughts?
Yeah, absolutely. Trump should not be talking to the opposition. If he's talking to the sovereign leader of Ukraine, and if Zelensky has offered to step aside for purpose of peace, then we should do that. I remember Charles Rangel, you know, as we can say, he got really irked over the head when I can't remember what it was. Someone was bad mouthing George W. Bush or whatever, and says he's my president. You know, say what? We're all Americans. Well, let's do it. So I don't think that would work out too well. He'd be definitely overplaying his hand.
Exactly. So we all agree on that one. Charlie Rango, boy, I thought it was kind of low of him to take his iPad when nobody was allowed to bring notes to his last debate. Rest in peace. I think he passed on, Charlie.
Oh, yeah, Rango? Yeah, a long time ago. Fellow New Yorker, yeah.
Yeah. John, you're frozen. I don't know if that's me. Okay, you're fine now. Okay, question five. Jake Tapper, Hypocrisy Hall of Famer, defending Biden's stutter versus stating he has cognitive decline, then cashing in on saying he was cognitive declining. So what this refers to is Jake Tapper was part of the cover-up when he was dealing with people who was saying Biden is in cognitive decline. There's a great video of him pretty much chastising, trying to demean Laura Trump, and then just ending the conversation when she was saying, look, the guy's like in mental decline. Now he turns around and says, hey, I got a book coming out, how he was in mental decline. So the question is, Jake Tapper a hypocrite for writing a book on Biden's decline after defending him, or is he just a savvy journalist? Big job.
Well, yeah, it's hypocritical. I don't think he's not by himself, or nor is he even remotely close to being the only guy who said one thing in front of the cameras and then did something else behind the scenes, right? I mean, CNN is famous for it. Fox News is famous for it. So it he's not unique, but yes, it is hypocritical without a doubt.
I don't even want to talk about Jake Tapper on this thing. That's an absolute mess. I'm not buying that book.
Miss Annette.
Yeah, I agree with both of them. But can I just say, it's really sad to see those clips of Joe Biden when he was sentient. And you know what? That's what got me. When you showed those clips of him, I was like, whoa. It didn't even seem like it was the same man. That really showed me over the last, well, it was 30 years or so, right? I mean, almost 30 years. But it was that stopped me in...
More like 40, but yeah.
40. Yeah, it was bad.
Yeah, that's when he was still young enough to be able to be racist in his speeches.
That was 1997.
97, so not quite 30.
Oh, it was 97? I thought it was in the 80s. Okay, yeah. Okay.
So my take is a little bit bigger. Yeah, he's a hypocrite. But what bothers me is this is information that these reporters have that they should be making public because that's your job. So to me, it's an ethics dilemma. They're putting their greed, the cash out, by holding back on stuff they find out and they research on so they can cash out on a book. And I've had issues with it. And John's right. They all do it. And this is not a major reason, but this just adds to why we don't trust the media. And I had to go to confession though. Biden was the first major politician I heard speak, and I was a Biden guy back in 1987 as freshman class president at UNC.
Oh.
Yeah.
Can I absolve you?
There we did Hail Mary's in the
potato. Okay.
All right. Here's where that's close to home. Trump's chance to dump Puerto Rico's freeloading and save a cool $617 billion. I just saw this today, so I don't have a lot of information, but Trump's being pushed by some. There's a seven-page executive order they've already drafted up to spin off, for lack of a better word. So MSNBC and Puerto Rico, they're going to be spun off from their owners, and it'll save us $617 billion. Should Trump push to make Puerto Rico independent? And as Armin said, you know, we are $37 trillion in debt, or is this a reckless gamble that's just going to create chaos? Let's start with the New Yorker there, Big John.
The economic reasons are not worthwhile. Like I say this all the time, you know, like people who there's reasons to let Puerto Rico go, there's reasons to get out of the Ukraine. Almost none of them come down to the economy. Our debt is not related. I say that all the time. If you added up all the foreign aid is 1.7% of the federal budget, right? So it's get rid of it all you want. Fine. I'm a libertarian. Let's cut all the costs. Get rid of all government as far as I'm concerned. But let's not pretend it's economics. He's making other statements by saying let's let Puerto Rico go. And you can infer what they are, but they're not
economically based. A group has come to him.
No. Yeah, there's always been Puerto Rican nationalists. They used to bomb out Francis Tavern in New York on Wall Street like once every 2 years in the 70s, right?
I claim no relations to those New Yorkers.
Right. Yeah, no, like, I don't know. Like, people have a right to secede. As a libertarian, I believe that. So if they don't want to be part of the U.S. and there's a sufficient movement for them to be let go, sure, let them go.
Armin.
Yeah, I think a lot of their nationalism is virtue signaling. I think if it really came down to it, if they had a real chance to leave the U.S. and become an independent nation, they wouldn't do it because they know if they did, they'd become just a side of Haiti, in terms of an economy. So they love the United States, but they'll say they want to be independent. I haven't really thought about it one way or the other, but I think it'd be very interesting to see if we call their bluff.
Yeah, I just don't know what percentage of the population backs those separatists. That's all. I just don't know enough about it.
But. I know, and I can't remember, but it's not like single digits, but I don't think it's huge. Annette?
I say drop the weight.
Drop the weight. Okay, so here's my take. Puerto Rico's, the U.S. is a brain drain for Puerto Ricans. The smart ones, the doctors, the lawyers, the ones who have ambition, they leave the island and they come to the States. So Puerto Rico's kind of screwed. I'm Puerto Rican. They are a welfare state. 60% of everything we send them gets spread out, and then it's a corrupt state. So as much as it pains me to say it, I think they would suffer early on. The brain drain would not happen, and they could create some kind of they wouldn't be Haiti, but I don't know how long it would take them to be self-sustaining because it's limited resources, limited things they could do, you know, so I don't know. But I do know part of Puerto Rico's problem today is the brain drain. All the ones with ambition are smart. The reason I know that, I know it from being Puerto Rican, but I also see it with my family. All the smart ones, they eventually come here. You know, when they retire, they'll go back to Puerto Rico. And I haven't thought about this a lot, so that's just my on the surface answer. I'll change my mind later.
William, one quick thing: to Puerto Rico is a tax haven to a lot of hedge funds and Peter Schiff. Yes. Peter Schiff took his entire company there, and he's living in Puerto Rico now because it's so tax advantaged. So, to your question, how do they become self sufficient? They become a tax haven, and it's very U.S. friendly. It's nearby, and the people speak English there. Why go off to some one of these other islands, you know, in the Caribbean, when you can just go to Puerto Rico if it were a full tax haven, and they could encourage that? Build a couple of casinos. Beat Cuba in 1950.
But here's the problem with that. It becomes truly a caste class. That's one reason Castro was able to win a revolution. So when I was talking, that was in the back of my head, is it should be a tourist trap. The problem is the corporations will come in and own everything, and the Puerto Ricans will become the equivalent of Latinos in Vegas and Chicago working in the hotels, you know? So my thought is we got to avoid that. So my answer was an off-the-cuff answer. I think there is a solution, but I do think – I don't see any reason – make it a state that's so nearby as some of them want. What's that?
I don't want to – Puerto Rico should not be the 51st state.
We got to wait for Canada first.
All right. Questions. So, in essence, it seems like the consensus is we don't really know what to do, but it is still new. I don't think it'll get past Trump's desk. It's a headache he doesn't want to deal with. You know, Newsom, shifty chameleon, saint. So, Armin, it's okay. You'll recover. You know, Carmen's like, Newsom has started a podcast. We're going to talk about this more in depth at Fired Up California, so stay tuned for that early next week. But Newsom has had a string of failed podcast shows and even the TV. He was on TV for a short while, if I'm correct. But he is savvy. California fires have destroyed him. So real quick. Is this podcast that he's trying to talk to MAGA and conservatives, is that him trying to make himself moderate? Because he sat there and said, no, I agree with the transgender, that men shouldn't be in women's sports, he told Charlie Kirk. But every action he's done has supported that. So I'll go first. No, I don't believe him. I think he's setting himself up to look like a moderate because he wants to be president in 2028. It burns me up because this is a brilliant move on his part, and the idiots are the conservatives who are going to go on his podcast. Armin, we'll go with you to get you out of your misery quickly.
6 years of having to deal with him and his dishonesty, his opposition to Prop 36 and pretty much everything else that's been good in this state. He had his little debate with Ron DeSantis, and he got his butt absolutely kicked. He can try all he wants, but he can try to run for president, but I don't think there's enough polishing that can make him a viable candidate.
Big John.
I mean, in principle, it's a good idea, right? Because he's not playing to Californians with that podcast. He's playing to the rest of the country, right? So it's a smart idea. Can he pull it off? Like, I didn't see the whole thing. I saw snippets of Charlie Kirk. Now, I'm no fan of Charlie Kirk's. I think he's a blowhard. But Charlie Kirk ate him alive. So if he's going to play this game, he better get a team in there. He better get a co-host that agrees with him. And just be in a position to soak up the victories where he can get them. Like, honestly, I would get him a co-host. I would say get him one of these stand-up comedians who basically all of them lean left. Have him sit in there and have him run the podcast that way. And at least, not to you Californians, but to the rest of the country, he has 4 years to look moderate. And that's the way I would do it.
Annette.
He needs to get a personality. He's slick. He's boring. He's Yeah, I mean, I saw him say that, and I was like, "Wow, can any? It doesn't. This is about talk about transparency. He was totally transparent."
In a lie, okay. So my,
setting himself up for the next election.
I want to add that John, you're right. He was eaten alive. DeSantis ate him alive. Charlie Kirk ate him alive. And this is what. This is what I fear. The more you practice, the more you get the opposing voice, the better you get. And that's what I fear. He'll be able to get better and the lies will not be convincing because he has been sheltered. He's been protected. So when he faces opposition, he has no answer because he's being hit with the truth. But he'll get better out of it. And real quick, 5.5% of the voters who turned out for the 2020 referendum want independence. So it is single digits. I was wrong. 2.75% of the population. So that's dead on arrival. The final hot take, and thank you to the audience for sticking around. I'm going to show these two videos first so you can digest and realize, damn, white people can't dance. Oh, I'm sorry. All right, before, at the last one, look what she drops. She almost falls over. No. This is the Democrats' current marketing. So you see, I don't need to go into it. This is what they're trying to use to counter Trump, the politics. This is their game plan. Does this flop? And I'm sorry, those are my words. You're right. This is me being biased. Does this, because it could be magical. Big John may think it belongs on Broadway. You know, does this flop show a Democratic Party so lost they're tossing spaghetti at the wall? I couldn't use the other word. Or do they genuinely think this train wreck will rally the public to their cause? How's that for a neutral question? Annette.
You're leading. It's silly. You can't take that seriously. Of course, I think they think this is what they have to do, though. I think that they look at Trump and they think, oh, maybe this is something that we can counter with and it's going to appeal to people in some way. I don't know what they're doing.
Big John, does it belong on Broadway?
No, of course not. But here's the thing. The first one I hadn't seen before, I don't know what the first one was.
That's at a state level. That's like Michigan or Massachusetts.
Yeah, that was just stupid, horrible. It was shot horribly. It was a mess. Yeah. The second one had potential. By the way, you know I'm going to give you an answer as an editor, right? As a video editor, right? It had potential if they went all in. Like, if they really made it like Street Fighter and they had gussied them up and put the pyros and the special effects. Like, because that's what they were trying to do, right? They were doing that bouncy, that if you're a Street Fighter fan,
Rocky,
right?
They were trying to do like Rocky or
something. No. It's from the Street Fighter game because at the end it said choose your fighter, right?
Oh, that's right. That's right.
And if you notice.
I didn't get that.
Yeah, and at the end, like if you notice the writing, this is why I'm saying the execution was horrible. You could barely read it. But it said like special power, like for AOC, it was special power, it was standing up to power or whatever it was, you know. So they were trying to present it like a Street Fighter. So I said they should have splurged, spent like $5,000, got in a real video editor, and that thing would have been slick. And it would have probably had a better effect on its intended audience. But like you said, they screwed the pooch. It looks horrible. They had a good theme, female fighters in Congress, right? And that's what that second one was. And that one should have been more effective than it was. But it's almost like halfway through they said, yeah, we give up. Just bounce around. And,
The last woman almost fell over when they dropped her.
Yeah, that was hilarious. Yeah.
You're a politician. You're involved in this. You're a former military guy. You're a sailor. You've seen everything from Girls Gone Wild, the strippers, the great dancers on TV, the everything. Where did this
you're putting out? Words in his mouth, William.
Whoa.
AOC special power is pounding her fists on the table and saying, listen to me, I'm important. No, it's not a good look. Even a lot of Democrats don't find it as a good look. And you've seen this thing where they're also, they're 40 of them are giving the same speech over and over again. I don't know who the heck is doing their marketing. Big John is right. I mean, I don't know whether Street Fighter is the right way to do it. I don't know that necessarily the Tron Cycles would be the right way to do it either. But I, you know, pick your video game if you want. There's ways of marketing and getting a point across that's fun, that's exciting, and that's serious. This just looks sad.
Yeah, it's the best word, Armin.
And I wanted to end on a light note there, but it looks pathetic. I mean, pathetic. And it's one of those things. I'm embarrassed for you, ladies. I'm embarrassed for you, and I'm a conservative, and I'm embarrassed for you. So that said, my friends, I want to thank Armin for being our guest. There you go, Armin. My final shot there.
That was good.
Yeah. So Armin, tell us a little bit about yourself and where people can find you on social media if you're up for that.
Sure. So I'm on Instagram at Real Armin Kurdian. I'm also on Facebook at A Kurdian. I've got Twitter, although I'm not on there very much. But I'm on, you'll see me on local and national media quite a bit. So News Nation, Fox 5 DC, KUSI here in San Diego, Fox News every now and then, Newsmax every now and then. Also NTD and ULFN. So I do a few hits on a weekly basis. And I'm going to keep fighting the good fight here in San Diego County. We had some problems here in San Diego County. Yes, we do. But we are on a bit of an upswing. And that's why I have taken a leadership role in the party down here to try to make things better.
Well, we're going to have to bring you up on our show called Fire Up California. We cover everything California, but we also try to focus on what's happening. We've actually held off on the local issues there. I'm like, it's too soon. Let's see how some of this fleshes out. But for the audience, you can check that out. Big John, tell us about your two shows real quick.
Sure. Yeah. So every Thursday, I drop Liberty Lens, where Mike Tremont and I will look at one specific issue of interest to libertarians. And then Thursday nights, we live stream Free for All. If you catch the uploaded version of last night's episode, you'll see me and Hody interviewing John Hudak, who runs the Faketarian site, who has been very good about exposing fake libertarians and people who would rather feel more at home with the Republican Party than with the Libertarian Party. So join us live Thursday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern, and then Liberty Lens, all at grumblingsmedia.com.
And for the audience, Ms. Annette Ross is finally going to get in the studio this upcoming week, and we're going to start testing her out for her own podcast. So
yeah,
be on the lookout for that. And for everybody else, thank you for tuning in. A rather long show, but it was all good information. I enjoyed the pushback we got with Armin. Big John always brings his take here, and Annette's always looking beautiful with her take. And I don't mean to miss you on purpose. You're just so quiet there in the corner, you know? And for everybody else, do not forget, you can check this, like and share this podcast, Fired Up, but you can check this podcast out along with our other ones, my other podcast, and bookmark grumblingsmedia.com. And you can check us out at YouTube and Rumble, Apple, Spotify, and Pandora under the handle Grumblings Media. And until next week, everybody stay fired up, and we'll see you then.